Chapter 45. Blade Master. The rising sun pushed its crimson edge above the horizon and sent long shadows down the cobblestone streets of Falma toward the harbor. A sea breeze bent the smoke of breakfast cook fires inland from the chimneys. Only the early risers were already out of doors, their breath making steam in the morning cold. Compared to the crowds that would fill the streets in another hour, the town seemed nearly empty. Sitting on an upended barrel in front of a still-closed ironmonger's shop, Nynaeve warmed her hands under her arms and surveyed her army. Min sat on a doorstep across the way, swathed in her Shan-Chan cloak and eating a wrinkled plum, and Elaine in her fleece coat huddled at the edge of an alley just down the street from her. A large sack pilfered from the docks lay neatly folded beside Min. "My army," Nynaeve thought grimly. "But there isn't anybody else." She caught sight of a Suldam and a Damani climbing the street, a yellow-haired woman wearing the bracelet and a dark woman the collar, both yawning sleepily. The few Falmen sharing the street with them averted their eyes and gave them a wide berth. As far as she could see, down toward the harbor, there was not another Shan-Chan. She did not turn her head the other way. Instead, she stretched and shrugged as if working cold shoulders before settling back as she had been. Min tossed her half-eaten plum aside, glanced casually up the street, and leaned back on the doorpost. The way was clear there, too, or she would have put her hands on her knees. Min had started rubbing her hands nervously, and Nynaeve realized that Elaine was now bouncing eagerly on her toes. "If they give us away, I'll thump both their heads." But she knew if they were discovered it would be the Shan-Chan who would say what happened to all three of them. She was all too aware that she had no real notion of whether what she planned would work or not. It could easily be her own failure that would give them away. Once again she resolved that if anything went wrong, she would somehow pull attention to herself while Min and Elaine escaped. She had told them to run if anything went wrong, and let them think she would run too. What she would do then she did not know. "Except I won't let them take me alive. Please, Light, not that." Suldam and Damani came up the street until they were bracketed by the three waiting women. A dozen Falmen walked wide of the linked pair. Nynaeve gathered all of her anger, leashed ones and leash holders. They had put their filthy collar on Egwene's neck, and they would put it on hers and Elaine's if they could. She had made Min tell her how Suldam enforced their will. She was sure Min had kept some back, the worst, but what she told was enough to heat Nynaeve to white-hot fury. In an instant, a white blossom on a black thorny branch had opened to Light, to Saidar, and the One Power filled her. She knew there was a glow around her, for those who could see it. The pale-skinned Suldam gave a start, and the dark Damani's mouth fell open, but Nynaeve gave them no chance. It was only a trickle of the power that she channeled, but she cracked it, a whip snapping a dust mote out of the air. The silver collar sprang open and clattered to the cobblestones. Nynaeve heaved a sigh of relief, even as she leaped to her feet. The Suldam stared at the fallen collar as if at a poisonous snake. The Damani put a shaking hand to her throat, but before the woman in the lightning-marked dress had time to move, the Damani turned and punched her in the face. The Suldam's knees buckled, and she almost fell. "Good for you!" Elaine shouted. She was already running forward, too, and so was Min. Before any of them reached the two women, the Damani took one startled look around, then ran as hard as she could. "We won't hurt you," Elaine called after her. "We are friends."
"Be quiet," Nynaeve hissed.
She produced a handful of rags from her pocket and ruthlessly stuffed them into the gaping mouth of the still staggering Suldam. Min hastily shook out the sack in a cloud of dust and plunged it over the Suldam's head, shrouding the woman to the waist.
"We are already attracting too much attention."
It was true, and yet not entirely true. The four of them stood in a rapidly emptying street, but the people who had decided to be elsewhere were avoiding looking at them. Nynaeve had been counting on that, people doing their best to ignore anything that had to do with Shan-Chen, to gain them a few moments. They would talk eventually, but in whispers. It might take hours for the Shan-Chan to learn anything had happened. The hooded woman began to struggle, making rag-muffled shouts from the sack.
but Nynaeve and Min threw their arms around her and wrestled her toward a nearby alley. The leash and collar trailed across the cobblestones behind them, clinking. "Pick it up," Nynaeve snapped at Elaine. "It won't bite you." Elaine took a deep breath, then gathered the silver metal gingerly, as if she feared it very well might. Nynaeve felt some sympathy, but not much. Everything rested on each of them doing as they had planned. The Suldam kicked and tried to throw herself free, but between them, Nynaeve and Min forced her along, down the alley into another slightly wider passage behind houses, to yet another alley, and at last into a rough wooden shed that had apparently once housed two horses, by the stalls. Few could afford to keep horses since the Shan Chan came, and in a day of Nynaeve's watching, no one had gone near it. The interior had a musty dustiness that spoke of abandonment. As soon as they were inside, Elaine dropped the silver leash and wiped her hands on some straw. Nynaeve channeled another trickle and the bracelet fell to the dirt floor. The Suldam squalled and hurled herself about. "Ready?" Nynaeve asked. The other two nodded, and they yanked the sacking off their prisoner. The Suldam wheezed, blue eyes teary from dust, but her red face was red as much from anger as from the sack. She darted for the door, but they caught her in the first step. She was not weak, yet they were three, and when they were done, the Suldam was stripped to her shift and lying in one of the stalls, bound hand and foot with stout cord, with another piece of cord to keep her from forcing the gag out. Soothing a puffy lip, Min eyed the lightning-paneled dress and soft boots they had laid out. "It might fit you, Nynaeve. It won't fit Elaine or me." Elaine was picking straw out of her hair. "I can see that. You were never a choice anyway, not really. They know you too well." Nynaeve hurriedly removed her own clothes. She tossed them aside and donned the Suldam's dress. Min helped with the buttons. Nynaeve wiggled her toes in the boots. They were a little tight. The dress was tight, too, across the bosom, and loose elsewhere. The hem hung almost to the ground, lower than Suldam wore them, but the fit would have been even worse on any of the others. Snatching up the bracelet, she took a deep breath and closed it around her left wrist. The ends merged, and it seemed solid. It did not feel like anything except a bracelet. She had been afraid that it would. "Get the dress, Elaine." They had dyed a pair of dresses, one of hers and one of Elaine's, to the gray Damani wore, or as close as they could manage, and hidden them here. Elaine did not move except to stare at the open collar and lick her lips. "Elaine, you have to wear it. Too many of them have seen Min for her to do it. I would have worn it if this dress had fit you instead." She thought she would have gone mad if she had had to wear the collar. That was why she could not make her voice sharp with Elaine now. "I know," Elaine sighed. "I just wish I knew more of what it does to you." She drew her red-gold hair out of the way. "Min, help me, please." Min began undoing the buttons down the back of her dress. Nynaeve managed to pick up the silver collar without flinching. "There is one way to find out." With only a moment of hesitation, she bent and snapped it around the neck of the Suldam. "She deserves it if anyone does," she told herself firmly. "She might be able to tell us something useful anyway." The blue-eyed woman glanced at the leash trailing from her neck to Nynaeve's wrist, then glared up at her contemptuously. "It doesn't work that way," Min said, but Nynaeve barely heard. She was aware of the other woman, aware of what she was feeling, cord digging into her ankles and into her wrists behind her back, the rank fish taste of the rags in her mouth, straw pricking her through the thin cloth of her shift. It was not as if she, Nynaeve, felt these things, but in her head was a lump of sensations that she knew belonged to the Suldam. She swallowed, trying to ignore them. They would not go away, and addressed the bound woman. "I won't hurt you if you answer my questions truthfully. We aren't Shan Chan." "But if you lie to me," she lifted the leash threateningly. The woman's shoulders shook, and her mouth curled around the gag in a sneer. It took Nynaeve a moment to realize the Suldam was laughing. Her mouth tightened, but then a thought came to her. That bundle of sensation inside her head seemed to be everything physical that the other woman felt. Experimentally, she tried adding to it. Eyes suddenly bulging out of her head, the Suldam gave a cry that the gag only partially stopped. Fanning her hands behind her as if trying to ward off something, she humped through the straw in a vain effort to escape. Nynaeve gaped and hastily rid herself of the extra feelings she had added. The Suldam sagged, weeping.
What did you do to her?
Elaine asked faintly. Min only stared, her mouth hanging open. Nynaeve answered gruffly. The same thing Shiriam did to you when you threw a cup at Marith. Light, but this is a filthy thing. Elaine gulped loudly.
Oh.
But an Eidam isn't supposed to work that way, Min said. They always claimed it won't work on any woman who cannot channel. I do not care how it is supposed to work, so long as it does. Nynaeve seized the silver metal leash right where it joined the collar and pulled the woman up enough to look her in the eyes. Frightened eyes, she saw. You listen to me and listen well. I want answers, and if I don't get them, I'll make you think I've had the hide off you. Stark terror rolled across the woman's face, and Nynaeve's stomach heaved as she suddenly realized the Suldam had taken her literally. If she thinks I can, it's because she knows. That is what these leashes are for. She took firm hold of herself to stop from clawing the bracelet off her wrist. Instead, she hardened her face. Are you ready to answer me, or do you need more convincing? The frantic head shaking was answer enough. When Nynaeve removed the gag, the woman only paused to swallow once before babbling,
I will not report you, I swear it. Only take this from my neck. I have gold. Take it. I swear I will never tell anyone.
Be quiet, Nynaeve snapped, and the woman shut her mouth immediately. What is your name?
Sita, please, I will answer you, but please take it off. If anyone sees it on me.
Sita's eyes rolled down to stare at the leash, then squeezed shut.
Please?
She whispered. Nynaeve realized something. She could never make Elaine wear that collar. Best we get on with it, Elaine said firmly. She was down to her shift, too, now. Give me a moment to put this other dress on and... Put your own clothes back on, Nynaeve said. Someone has to pretend to be a Damani, Elaine said, or we will never reach Egwene. That dress fits you and it cannot be Min. That leaves me. I said, put your clothes on. We have somebody to be our leashed one. Nynaeve tugged at the leash that held Sita, and the Suldam gasped.
No, no, please, if anyone sees me.
She cut off at Nynaeve's cold stare. As far as I'm concerned, you are worse than a murderer, worse than a dark friend. I can't think of anything worse than you. The fact that I have to wear this thing on my wrist to be the same as you for even an hour sickens me. So if you think there is anything I'll balk at doing to you, think again. You don't want to be seen? Good. Neither do we. No one really looks at a Damani, though. As long as you keep your head down the way a leashed one is supposed to, no one will even notice you. But you had better do the best you can to make sure the rest of us aren't noticed either. If we are, you surely will be seen. And if that is not enough to hold you, I promise you I'll make you curse the first kiss your mother ever gave your father. Do we understand each other?
Yes,
Sita said faintly.
I swear it.
Nynaeve had to remove the bracelet in order for them to slide Elaine's gray-dyed dress down the leash and over Sita's head. It did not fit the woman well, being loose at the bosom and tight across the hips, but Nynaeve's would have been as bad, and too short besides. Nynaeve hoped people really did not look at Damani. She put the bracelet back on reluctantly. Elaine gathered up Nynaeve's clothes, wrapped the other dyed dress around them, and made a bundle for a woman in farm clothes to be carrying as she followed a Suldam and a Damani.
Gawain will eat his heart out when he hears about this, she said, and laughed.
It sounded forced. Nynaeve looked at her closely, then at Min. It was time for the dangerous part. Are you ready? Elaine's smile faded.
I am ready.
Ready, Min said curtly.
Where are you, going?
Sita said, quickly adding, if I may ask. Into the lion's den, Elaine told her. To dance with the Dark One, Min said. Nynaeve sighed and shook her head. What they are trying to say is, we are going where all the Demani are kept and we intend to free one of them. Sita was still gaping in astonishment when they hustled her out of the shed.
Bail Doman watched the rising sun from the deck of his ship. The docks were already beginning to bustle, though the streets leading up from the harbor stood largely empty. A gull perched on a piling stared at him. Gulls had pitiless eyes.
"Are you sure about this, Captain?" Yaren asked. "If the Shonchan wonder what we're all doing aboard..."
"You just make certain there do be an axe near every mooring line," Doman said curtly. "And Yaren, do any man try to cut a line before those women are aboard, I will split his skull."
"And what if they don't come, Captain? What if it's Shonchan soldiers instead?"
"Settle your bowels, man. If soldiers come, I'll make a run for the harbor mouth, and the light have mercy on us all. But until soldiers do come, I mean to wait for those women. Now go look as if you are no doing anything."
Doman turned back to peering up into the town toward where the Demani were held. His fingers drummed a nervous tattoo on the railing. The breeze from the sea brought the smell of breakfast cook fires to Rand's nose and tried to flap at his moth-eaten cloak, but he held it closed with one hand as Red neared the town. There had not been a coat to fit him in the clothes they had found, and he thought it best to keep the fine silver embroidery on his sleeves and the herons on his collar hidden. The Shonchan attitude toward conquered people carrying weapons might not extend to those with heron-marked swords either. The first shadows of morning stretched out ahead of him. He could just see Huron riding in among the wagon yards and horse lots. Only one or two men moved among the lines of merchant wagons, and they wore the long aprons of wheelwrights or blacksmiths. Ingtar, the first in, was already out of sight. Perrin and Matt followed behind Rand at spaced intervals. He did not look back to check on them. There was not supposed to be anything to connect them. Five men coming into Falma at an early hour, but not together. The horse lots surrounded him, horses already crowding the fences, waiting to be fed. Yuren put his head out from between two stables, their doors still closed and barred, saw Rand and motioned to him before ducking back. Rand turned the bay stallion that way. Yuren stood holding his horse by the reins. He had on one of the long vests instead of his coat, and despite the heavy cloak that hid his short sword and sword breaker, he shivered with the cold.
"Lord Ingtar's back there," he said, nodding down the narrow passage. "He says we'll leave the horses here and go the rest of the way on foot."
As Rand dismounted, the sniffer added,
"Fane went right down that street, Lord Rand. I can almost smell it from here."
Rand led Red down the way to where Ingtar had already tied his own horse behind the stable. The Shinaran did not look very much a lord in a dirty fleece coat with holes worn through the leather in several places, and his sword looked odd belted over it. His eyes had a feverish intensity. Tying Red alongside Ingtar's stallion, Rand hesitated over his saddlebags. He had not been able to leave the banner behind. He did not think any of the soldiers would have gone into the bags, but he could not say the same for Varen, nor predict what she would do if she found the banner. Still, it made him uneasy to have it with him. He decided to leave the saddlebags tied behind his saddle. Matt joined them, and a few moments later, Huron came with Perrin. Matt wore baggy trousers stuffed into the tops of his boots, and Perrin his too short cloak. Rand thought they all looked like villainous beggars, but they had all passed largely unnoticed in the villages.
"Now," Ingtar said, "let us see what we see."
They strolled out to the dirt street as if they had no particular destination in mind, talking among themselves, and ambled past the wagon yards onto sloping cobblestone streets. Rand was not sure what he himself said, much less anyone else. Ingtar's plan had been for them to look like any other group of men walking together, but there were all too few people out of doors. Five men made a crowd on those cold morning streets. They walked in a bunch, but it was Huron who led them, sniffing the air and turning up this street and down that. The rest turned when he did, as if that was what they had intended all along.
"He's crisscrossed this town," Huron muttered, grimacing. "His smell is everywhere,
and it stinks so it's hard to tell old from new. At least I know he's still here. Some of it cannot be older than a day or two, I'm sure. I am sure, he added less doubtfully. A few more people began to appear, here a fruit peddler setting his wares on tables, there a fellow hurrying along with a big roll of parchments under his arm and a sketchboard slung across his back, a knife sharpener oiling the shaft of his grinding wheel on its barrow. Two women walked by, headed the other way, one with downcast eyes and a silver collar around her neck, the other in a dress worked with lightning bolts, holding a coiled silver leash. Rand's breath caught. It was an effort not to look back at them.
Was that?
Matt's eyes were open wide, staring out of the hollows of his eye sockets.
Was that a Damani?
That is the way they were described, Ingtar said curtly. Huron, are we going to walk every street in this shadow-cursed town?
He's been everywhere, Lord Ingtar, Huron said. His stench is everywhere.
They had come into an area where the stone houses were 3 and 4 stories high, as big as inns. They rounded a corner, and Rand was taken aback by the sight of a score of Shanchan soldiers standing guard in front of a big house on one side of the street, and by the side of 2 women in lightning-marked dresses talking on the doorsteps of another across from it. A banner flapped in the wind over the house the soldiers protected, a golden hawk clutching lightning bolts. Nothing marked out the house where the women talked except themselves. The officer's armor was resplendent in red and black and gold, his helmet gilded and painted to look like a spider's head. Then Rand saw the 2 big leathery-skinned shapes, crouched among the soldiers, and missed a step.
Grom.
There was no mistaking those wedge-shaped heads with their 3 eyes.
They can't be.
Perhaps he was really asleep, and this was all a nightmare.
Maybe we haven't even left for Falma yet.
The others stared at the beasts as they walked past the guarded house.
What in the name of light are they?
Matt asked. Huron's eyes seemed as big as his face.
Lord Rand, they're... those are...
It doesn't matter, Rand said. After a moment, Huron nodded.
We are here for the horn, Ingtar said, not to stare at Shanchan monsters. Concentrate on finding Fane, Huron.
The soldiers barely glanced at them. The street ran straight down to the round harbor. Rand could see ships anchored down there, tall, square-looking ships with high masts, small in that distance.
He's been here a lot,
Huron scrubbed at his nose with the back of his hand.
The street stinks of layer on layer of him. I think he might have been here as late as yesterday, Lord Ingtar. Maybe last night.
Matt suddenly clutched his coat with both hands.
It's in there, he whispered.
He turned around and walked backwards, peering at the tall house with the banner.
The dagger is in there. I didn't even notice it before, because of those things, but I can feel it.
Perrin poked a finger in his ribs. Well, stop that before they start wondering why you're goggling at them like a fool. Rand glanced over his shoulder. The officer was looking after them. Matt turned around sullenly.
Are we just going to keep on walking? It's in there, I tell you.
The horn is what we are after, Ingtar growled. I mean to find Fane and make him tell me where it is. He did not slow down. Matt said nothing, but his entire face was a plea.
I have to find Fane too, Rand thought. I have to.
But when he looked at Matt's face, he said,
Ingtar, if the dagger is in that house, Fane likely is too. I can't see him letting the dagger or the horn, either one, far out of his sight.
Ingtar stopped. After a moment, he said,
It could be, but we will never know from out here.
We could watch for him to come out, Rand said. If he comes out at this time of the morning, then he spent the night there. And I'll wager where he sleeps is where the horn is. If he does come out, we can be back to Varen by midday and have a plan made before nightfall.
I do not mean to wait for Varen, Ingtar said. And neither will I wait for night. I've waited too long already. I mean to have the horn in my hands before the sun sets again.
But we don't know, Ingtar.
I know the dagger is in there, Matt said.
And Huron says Fane was here last night. Ingtar overrode Huron's attempts to qualify that.
It is the first time you have been willing to say anything closer than a day or two. We are going to take back the horn now. Now!
How?
Rand said. The officer was no longer watching them, but there were still at least 20 soldiers in front of the building, and a pair of Grolm.
This is madness. There can't be Grolm here.
Thinking it did not make the beasts disappear, though. There seems to be gardens behind all these houses, Ingtar said, looking around thoughtfully. If one of those alleys runs by a garden wall, sometimes men are so busy guarding their front, they neglect their back. Come. He headed straight for the nearest narrow passage between two of the tall houses. Huron and Matt trotted right after him. Rand exchanged looks with Perrin. His curly-haired friend gave a resigned shrug, and they followed too. The alley was barely wider than their shoulders, but it ran between high garden walls until it crossed another alley big enough for a push-barrow or small cart. That was cobblestoned, too, but only the backs of buildings looked down on it, shuttered windows and expanses of stone, and the high back walls of gardens overtopped by nearly leafless branches. Ingtar led them along that alley until they were opposite the waving banner. Taking his steel-backed gauntlets from under his coat, he put them on and leaped up to catch the top of the wall, then pulled himself up enough to peek over. He reported in a low monotone, "Trees. Flower beds. Walks. There isn't a soul to be. Wait. A guard. One man. He isn't even wearing his helmet. Count to 50, then follow me." He swung a boot to the top of the wall and rolled inside, disappearing before Rand could say a word. Matt began to count slowly. Rand held his breath. Perrin fingered his axe, and Huron gripped the hilts of his weapons.
50.
Huron scrambled up and over the wall before the word was well out of Matt's mouth. Perrin went right beside him. Rand thought Matt might need some help. He looked so pale and drawn, but he gave no sign of it as he scrambled up. The stone wall provided plenty of handholds, and moments later, Rand was crouched on the inside with Matt and Perrin and Huron. The garden was in the grip of deep autumn, flower beds empty except for a few evergreen shrubs, tree branches nearly bare. The wind that rippled the banner stirred dust across the flagstone walks. For a moment, Rand could not find Ingtar. Then he saw the Shinaran flat against the back wall of the house, motioning them on with sword in hand. Rand ran in a crouch, more conscious of the windows blankly peering down from the house than of his friends running beside him. It was a relief to press himself against the house beside Ingtar. Matt kept muttering to himself, "It's in there, I can feel it."
"Where's the guard?" Rand whispered.
"Dead," Ingtar said. "The man was overconfident. He never even tried to raise a cry. I hid his body under one of those bushes."
Rand stared at him. The Shonchan was overconfident? The only thing that kept him from going back right then was Matt's anguished murmurs.
"We are almost there,"
Ingtar sounded as if he were speaking to himself, too.
"Almost there. Come."
Rand drew his sword as they started up the back steps. He was aware of Huron unlimbering his short-bladed sword and notched swordbreaker, and Perrin reluctantly drawing his axe from the loop of his belt. The hallway inside was narrow. A half-open door to their right smelled like a kitchen. Several people were moving about in that room. There was an indistinguishable sound of voices and occasionally the soft clatter of a pot lid. Ingtar motioned Matt to lead, and they crept by the door. Rand watched the narrowing opening until they were around the next corner. A slender young woman with dark hair came out of a door ahead of them, carrying a tray with one cup. They all froze. She turned the other way without looking in their direction. Rand's eyes widened. Her long white robe was all but transparent. She vanished around another corner.
"Did you see that?" Matt said hoarsely. "You could see right through."
Ingtar clapped a hand over Matt's mouth and whispered,
"Keep your mind on why we are here. Now find it. Find the horn for me."
Matt pointed to a narrow set of winding stairs. They climbed a flight, and he led them toward the front of the house. The furnishings in the hallways were sparse and seemed all curves. Here and there, a tapestry hung on a wall or a folding screen stood against it, each painted with a few birds on branches or a flower or two. A river flowed across one screen, but aside from rippling water and narrow strips of riverbank, the rest of it was blank. All around them, Rand could hear the sounds of people stirring, slippers scuffing on the floor, soft murmurs of speech. He did not see anyone, but he could imagine it all too well, someone stepping into the hall to see five slinking men with weapons in their hands, shouting an alarm.
"In there,"
Matt whispered, pointing to a big pair of sliding doors ahead, carved handholds their only ornamentation.
"At least the dagger is."
Ingtar looked at Huron. The sniffer slid the doors open, and Ingtar leaped through with his sword ready. There was no one there. Rand and the others hurried inside, and Huron quickly closed the doors behind them. Painted screens hid all the walls and any other doors, and veiled the light coming through windows that had to overlook the street. At one end of the big room stood a tall circular cabinet. At the other was a small table, the lone chair on the carpet turned to face it. Rand heard Ingtar gasp, but he only felt like heaving a sigh of relief. The curling golden horn of Valir sat on a stand on the table. Below it, the ruby in the hilt of the ornate dagger caught the light. Matt darted to the table, snatching horn and dagger.
"We have it," he crowed, shaking the dagger in his fist. "We have both of them." "Not so loud," Perrin said with a wince. "We don't have them out of here yet."
His hands were busy on the haft of his axe. They seemed to want to be holding something else.
"The horn of Valir."
There was sheer awe in Ingtar's voice. He touched the horn hesitantly, tracing a finger along the silver script inlaid around the bell, and mouthing the translation, then pulled his hand back with a shiver of excitement.
"It is. By the light it is. I am saved."
Huron was moving the screens that hid the windows. He shoved the last one out of his way and peered into the street below.
"Those soldiers are all still there, looking like they've took root."
He shuddered.
"Those things, too."
Rand went to join him. The two beasts were Grom. There was no denying it.
"How did they?"
As he lifted his eyes from the street, words died. He was looking over a wall into the garden of the big house across the street. He could see where further walls had been torn down, joining other gardens to it. Women sat on benches there or strolled along the walks, always in pairs. Women linked, neck to wrist, by silver leashes. One of the women with a collar around her neck looked up. He was too far to make out her face clearly, but for an instant it seemed that their eyes met, and he knew. The blood drained from his face.
"Egwene,"
he breathed.
"What are you talking about?" Matt said. "Egwene is safe in Tarvalin. I wish I were."
"She's here," Rand said.
The two women were turning, walking toward one of the buildings on the far side of the joined gardens.
"She is there, right across the street. Oh, light, she's wearing one of those collars."
"Are you sure?" Perrin said.
He came to peer from the window.
"I don't see her, Rand, and I could recognize her if I did, even at this distance."
"I am sure," Rand said.
The two women disappeared into one of the houses that faced the next street over. His stomach was twisted into a knot.
"She is supposed to be safe. She's supposed to be in the White Tower.
I have to get her out. The rest of you."
"So..." The slurring voice was as soft as the sound of the doors sliding in their tracks.
"You are not who I expected."
For a brief moment, Rand stared. The tall man with the shaven head who had stepped into the room wore a long trailing blue robe, and his fingernails were so long that Rand wondered if he could handle anything. The two men standing obsequiously behind him had only half their dark hair shaved, the rest hanging in a dark braid down each man's right cheek. One of them cradled a sheathed sword in his arms. It was only a moment he had for staring, then screens toppled to reveal, at either end of the room, a doorway crowded with four or five Shanshan soldiers, bareheaded but armored, and swords in hand.
"You are in the presence of the High Lord Turok,"
the man who carried the sword began, staring at Rand and the others angrily, but a brief motion of a finger with a blue lacquered nail cut him short. The other servant stepped forward with a bow and began undoing Turok's robe.
"When one of my guards was found dead," the shaven-headed man said calmly, "I suspected the man who calls himself Fane. I have been suspicious of him since Juan died so mysteriously, and he has always wanted that dagger."
He held out his arms for the servant to remove his robe.
despite his soft, almost singing voice. Hard muscles roped his arms and smooth chest, which was bare to a blue sash holding wide white trousers that seemed made of hundreds of pleats. He sounded uninterested and indifferent to the blades in their hands.
"And now to find strangers with not only the dagger, but the horn. It will please me to kill one or two of you for disturbing my morning. Those who survive will tell me of who you are and why you came."
He stretched out a hand without looking. The man with the scabbarded sword laid the hilt in the hand and drew the heavy curved blade.
"I would not have the horn damaged."
Turok gave no other signal, but one of the soldiers stalked into the room and reached for the horn. Rand did not know whether he should laugh or not. The man wore armor, but his arrogant face seemed as oblivious to their weapons as Turok was. Matt put an end to it. As the Shan-Chan reached out his hand, Matt slashed it with the ruby-hilted dagger. With a curse, the soldier leaped back, looking surprised. And then he screamed. It chilled the room, held everyone where they stood in astonishment. The trembling hand he held up in front of his face was turning black, darkness creeping outwards from the bleeding gash that crossed his palm. He opened his mouth wide and howled, clawing at his arm, then his shoulder. Kicking, jerking, he toppled to the floor, thrashing on the silken carpet, shrieking as his face grew black and his dark eyes bulged like overripe plums, until a dark, swollen tongue gagged him. He twisted, choking raggedly, heels drumming, and did not move again. Every bit of his exposed flesh was black as putrid pitch and looked ready to burst at a touch. Matt licked his lips and swallowed. His grip shifted uneasily on the dagger. Even Turok stared, open-mouthed.
"You see," Ingtar said softly, "we are no easy meat."
Suddenly he leaped over the corpse, toward the soldiers still goggling at what was left of the man who had stood at their shoulders only moments before.
"Shinoa," he cried, "follow me!"
Hiran leaped after him, and the soldiers fell back before them, the sounds of steel on steel rising. The Shan-Chan at the other end of the room started forward as Ingtar moved, but then they were falling back too, before Matt's thrusting dagger, even more than from the axe Perrin swung with wordless snarls. In the space of heartbeats, Rand stood alone, facing Turok, who held his blade upright before him. His moment of shock was gone. His eyes were sharp on Rand's face. The black and swollen body of one of his soldiers might as well not have existed. It did not seem to exist for the two servants either, any more than Rand and his sword existed, or the sounds of fighting, fading now from the rooms to either side, out into the house. The servants had begun calmly folding Turok's robe as soon as the High Lord took his sword, and had not looked up even for the dead soldier's shrieks. Now they knelt beside the door and watched with impassive eyes.
"I suspected it might come to you and me."
Turok spun his blade easily, a full circle one way, then the other, his long-nailed fingers moving delicately on the hilt. His fingernails did not seem to hamper him at all.
"You are young. Let us see what is required to earn the heron on this side of the ocean."
Suddenly, Rand saw. Standing tall on Turok's blade was a heron. With the little training he had, he was face to face with a real blade master. Hastily, he tossed the fleece-lined cloak aside, ridding himself of weight and encumbrance. Turok waited. Rand desperately wanted to seek the void. It was plain he would need every shred of ability he could muster, and even then his chances of leaving the room alive would be small. He had to leave alive. Egwene was almost close enough for him to shout to her, and he had to free her somehow. But Sidene waited in the void. The thought made his heart leap with eagerness at the same time that it turned his stomach. But just as close as Egwene were those other women, Damani. If he touched Sidene, and if he could not stop himself channeling, they would know, Varen had told him. Know and wonder. So many so close. He might survive Turok only to die facing Damani, and he could not die before Egwene was free. Rand raised his blade. Turok glided toward him on silent feet. Blade rang on blade like hammer on anvil. From the first, it was clear to Rand that the man was testing him, pushing only hard enough to see what he could do, then pushing a little harder, then just a little harder still. It was quick wrists and quick feet that kept Rand alive as much as skill. Without the void, he was always half a heartbeat behind. The tip of Turok's heavy sword made a stinging trench just under his left eye. A flap of coat sleeve hung away from his shoulder, the darker for being wet. Under a neat slash beneath his right arm, precise as a tailor's cut, he could feel warm dampness spreading down his ribs. There was disappointment on the High Lord's face. He stepped back with a gesture of disgust.
"Where did you find that blade, boy? Or do they here truly award the heron to those no more skilled than you? No matter. Make your peace. It is time to die."
He came on again. The void enveloped Rand. Sidene flowed toward him, glowing with the promise of the One Power, but he ignored it. It was no more difficult than ignoring a barbed thorn twisting in his flesh. He refused to be filled with the power, refused to be one with the male half of the true source. He was one with the sword in his hands, one with the floor beneath his feet, one with the walls, one with Turok. He recognized the forms the High Lord used. They were a little different from what he had been taught, but not enough. The swallow takes flight met parting the silk. Moon on the water met the wood grouse dances. Ribbon in the air met stones falling from the cliff. They moved about the room as in a dance, and their music was steel against steel. Disappointment and disgust faded from Turok's dark eyes, replaced by surprise, then concentration. Sweat appeared on the High Lord's face as he pressed Rand harder. Lightning of three prongs met leaf on the breeze. Rand's thoughts floated outside the void, apart from himself, hardly noticed. It was not enough. He faced a blade master, and with the void and every ounce of his skill, he was barely managing to hold his own. Barely. He had to end it before Turok finally did.
"Sidene, no. Sometimes it is necessary to sheathe the sword in your own flesh."
But that would not help Egwene either. He had to end it now. Now. Turok's eyes widened as Rand glided forward. So far, he had only defended. Now he attacked all out. The boar rushes down the mountain. Every movement of his blade was an attempt to reach the High Lord. Now all Turok could do was retreat and defend, down the length of the room, almost to the door. In an instant, while Turok still tried to face the boar, Rand charged. The river undercuts the bank. He dropped to one knee, blade slashing across. He did not need Turok's gasp or the feel of resistance to his cut to know. He heard two thumps and turned his head, knowing what he would see. He looked down the length of his blade, wet and red, to where the High Lord lay, sword tumbled from his limp hand, a dark dampness staining the birds woven in the carpet under his body. Turok's eyes were still open, but already filmed with death. The void shook. He had faced Trollocs before, faced Shadowspawn. Never before had he confronted a human being with a sword, except in practice or bluff.
"I just killed a man."
The void shook, and Sidene tried to fill him. Desperately, he clawed free, breathing hard as he looked around. He gave a start when he saw the two servants still kneeling beside the door. He had forgotten them, and now he did not know what to do about them. Neither man appeared armed, yet all they had to do was shout. They never looked at him or at each other. Instead, they stared silently at the High Lord's body. They produced daggers from under their robes, and he tightened his grip on the sword, but each man placed the point to his own breast.
"From birth to death," they intoned in unison, "I serve the blood,"
and plunged the daggers into their own hearts. They folded forward almost peacefully, heads to the floor as if bowing deeply to their lord. Rand stared at them in disbelief.
"Mad," he thought. "Maybe I will go mad, but they already were."
He was getting to his feet shakily when Ingtar and the others came running back. They all bore nicks and cuts. The leather of Ingtar's coat was stained in more than one place. Matt still had the horn and his dagger, its blade darker than the ruby in its hilt. Perrin's axe was red, too, and he looked as if he might be sick at any moment.
"You dealt with them?" Ingtar said, looking at the bodies. "Then we're done, if no alarm is given. Those fools never cried for help, not once."
I will see if the guards heard anything, Huron said, and darted for the window. Matt shook his head.
Rand, these people are crazy. I know I've said that before, but these people really are. Those servants...
Rand held his breath, wondering if they had all killed themselves. Matt said,
Whenever they saw us fighting, they fell on their knees, put their faces to the floor, and wrapped their arms around their heads. They never moved or cried out, never tried to help the soldiers or give an alarm. They're still there, as far as I know.
I would not count on them staying on their knees, Ingtar said dryly. We are leaving now, as fast as we can run.
You go, Rand said.
Egwene, you fool! Ingtar snapped. We have what we came for, the Horn of Valir, the hope of salvation. What can one girl count, even if you love her, alongside the Horn and what it stands for? The Dark One can have the Horn for all I care. What is finding the Horn count if I abandon Egwene to this? If I did that, the Horn couldn't save me. The Creator couldn't save me. I would damn myself. Ingtar stared at him, his face unreadable.
You mean that exactly, don't you?
Something's happening out there, Huron said urgently. A man just came running up, and they're all milling like fish in a bucket. Wait, the officer is coming inside.
Go, Ingtar said.
He tried to take the horn, but Matt was already running. Rand hesitated, but Ingtar grabbed his arm and pulled him into the hall. The others were streaming after Matt. Perrin only gave Rand one pained look before he went.
You cannot save the girl if you stand here and die.
He ran with them. Part of him hated himself for running, but another part whispered,
I'll come back. I'll free her somehow.
By the time they reached the bottom of the narrow, winding staircase, he could hear a man's deep voice raised in the front part of the house, angrily demanding that someone stand up and speak. A serving girl in her nearly transparent robe knelt at the bottom of the stairs, and a gray-haired woman, all in white wool, with a long, flowery apron, knelt by the kitchen door. They were both exactly as Matt had described, faces to the floor and arms wrapped around their heads, and they did not stir a hair as Rand and the others hurried by. He was relieved to see the motions of breathing. They crossed the garden at a dead run, climbing over the back wall rapidly. Ingtar cursed when Matt tossed the Horn of Valir ahead of him and tried again to take it when he dropped outside, but Matt snatched it up with a quick, "It isn't even scratched," and scampered up the alley. More shouts rose from the house they had just left. A woman screamed, and someone began tolling a gong.
I will come back for her, somehow.
Rand sped after the others as fast as he could.